JEA's entire board is gone, along with its CEO. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, we welcome City Councilman Matt Carlucci about the latest incredible news in the JEA affair. You can join us. Weigh in with your thoughts. It's 549-2937. Then later, Ancient Egypt comes to life at Jacksonville's Kummer Museum this month. That's coming up later. But first this morning, more bombshells at JEA. Yesterday, the JEA Board of Directors voted unanimously to fire former CEO Aaron Zahn with cause. That means he'll get no hefty severance package from the utility. But then, how about this? The entire JEA board stepped down all at the same time. It is the latest twist in the long-running scandal at the city's utility. Lots to discuss. Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci, one of the first on the council to call for an end to the privatization process of JEA, joins us now with more. Councilman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. What are your thoughts about the JEA board stepping down, the CEO gone? And a few minutes after we discuss that, we'll talk about the city's new resiliency committee as well. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And already getting your comments on Facebook. Okay, so very big news yesterday, Councilman Carlucci. The board gave Aaron Zahn the boot with no golden parachute, something the public and city officials overwhelmingly approve of. But then the entire board said they'll leave their positions by the end of February. That was not necessarily expected.
No, that was a shocker to me. I'm glad that the chairperson who called for termination with cause, April Green, I'm glad that she resigned before that happened because she left on her own terms. And I don't know how all that went down, but I know that she resigned first. I mean, I want to say that there's some people on that board that are good people. They care about Jacksonville, and it's unfortunate that that they got caught up in this big mess that was caused by Aaron Zahn. And I have information that the Office of the General Counsel provided me of their investigation. He provided it to everybody, not just to me. So, and I told him I was going to be on your show, and he said, yeah, I could share whatever because it's public record. But it all comes down to Aaron Zahn and certain members of his leadership team, and I don't know who they are right now. I think I do, but I don't want to go there because I don't know for sure. But they were selectively giving that board information that was not complete, that would cast a bad light on the future of the JEA. That board was being manipulated. The people on that board, they don't make a nickel. They're giving of their time. And now, should they have been more conscientious looking back, they might think maybe we should have been. But you go on a board and you want to serve and you want to trust the leadership team. You want to play as a team. And then you start finding out, well, a lot of this stuff is not making up. It's not making sense. It's not adding up. And that was, and I'm going to tell you, the investigation of the attorney of Jason Gabriel, our general counsel, took a long time, but it is complete. It is thorough. Because at this point, Aaron Zahn could try to go to mediation between the two because he's got a contract. And that's why it took so long. When a business person hires somebody, there's not necessarily a real contract necessarily, but these contracts for these CEOs, I mean, they are so put together by lawyers. My attorney, my apologies to all attorneys. You can call up and call me a politician, but or an insurance agent, whatever.
Yeah, sure. And it's not surprising that Aaron Zahn might try to legally make the case for some severance. But but let me ask you as well, following upon the news that the whole board is leaving, most of them left immediately. One member, Kelly Flanagan, will continue until her term expires at the end of February. There was a statement released by Mayor Curry. He says he will work with City Council to appoint a new executive board of directors as soon as possible, understanding that among their first orders of business will be rebuilding public trust and strengthening the future of this vital and valued community asset. The mayor's taking a lot of criticism for this latest turn of events, given that he appointed these board members after first purging the JEA board before the prior members' terms were even completed. Critics said so that he could further the goal of privatizing JEA. So how do you respond to this statement from the mayor's office, and how will the city council work with him to refill the board?
Well, I didn't see the statement. And first of all, before a lot of things go down, and I don't want to be taking easy shots, I don't want to politicize this, but I'm just going to lay it out the way I see it. Before you make big decisions like this, generally, a mayor will have his council liaisons go and brief each city council member on what's happening. That's a great way to engender trust with your city council. So I heard through some party, I can't remember who it was, that hit the whole board was going to be fired, and or not fired, but asked to leave or replaced. I'm not sure how all that went down, but and then I heard that he was going to work with the city council to. I'm hearing this just like I heard, you know, when they were going to sell the JEA, when they were going to enter into the ITN process. I found out about that reading the Financial Daily News and Record. So there's no communication, at least not with this council member. Mm. And I've never experienced that before. The Ed Austins, the John Delaney's, the John Paytons, the other Tommy Azuri, Alvin Brown, even when I didn't serve with some of these mayors, and a lot of times they would call me and just say, hey, this is coming down the pike. We'll let you know why. No, we're not getting that. I'm not getting that kind of communication, and I'm not sure how many other people on the council are. I'm not going to speak for them.
So certainly you're advocating for more open lines of communication to rebuild trust. Let's say that happens. How will the board be reappointed? The council will have a voice, and you're certainly getting a lot of pressure from voters to perhaps change the way these positions are appointed. Do you think that needs to be looked at?
Well, that was brought up last night by Council Member Garrett Dennis. He said, you know, before we start appointing new members, what about the legislation we have that would have the mayor make four appointments and the council make three? This is kind of the way I look at it, and you can't really look at it like this now because of everything that's happened. But in the past, for the most part, our independent authorities have worked very well independently. And the appointments that were made were never interfered with by a mayor that I ever saw. And they were appointed, go do your job. They picked the best CEO that they could find in the country to run the JEA. And the JEA has performed extremely well. Extremely well under Paul McElroy. Its latest audit that came out so strong about financial and operationally, how strong the JEA is, a lot of that goes back to the McElroy years. So, but they had to do a lot of manipulating to change, you know, what came out in that audit to make it look so bad at the JEA. And I never believed it. You know what? I've been around long enough that I don't need to see spreadsheets and audits sometimes to know what's wrong.
Well, and as a federal investigation into this proceeds, along with a city council investigation, we will theoretically, ostensibly learn more about how this all was constructed within the senior leadership of JEA. Let me get your reaction to a statement from the local Democratic Party. They welcome the decision of the JEA board to terminate Aaron Zahn with cause. But ultimately, the board and the mayor are responsible for appointing, promoting, and retaining an unqualified showman to run a multi-billion-dollar utility with 24 findings of misconduct, gross negligence, and breach of fiduciary obligations by Aaron Zahn, documented by the Office of General Counsel. These shocking findings justify the concerns many community leaders have expressed in hiring the unqualified personal friend of the mayor for such a position. And they are also pushing, as you said, a change in the way these board members are appointed to allow more input from the city council and cause independent agencies to truly be independent.
Well, I'm open to listening to any changes that need to be made. But under ordinary times, when government is functioning the way it should be, you know, I would tend to leave independent authorities alone. At this point, we can't, because the community expects some oversight, and they're looking to the council and the other entities that may be investigating and so forth, and our council's investigation to show some accountability to what's happening. But ordinarily, we got enough on our plate to work on without having to get into the minutia of these authorities.
Let's go to some calls now for Councilman at Large Matt Carlucci. Scott is on the north side. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm in disagreement with the city councilman because there has been a history of JEA when it comes to bonuses for the CEO and other members of the operation for JEA. But I am concerned about the city council popping up at the last minute when this issue was going on. If it wasn't for WJCT and the Time Union, a lot of this would have been pushed up under the mat.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. Let me since we have so many folks on hold, let's get to
under
it.
Under the mat, no pun intended.
Okay, what about the criticism that the council was slow to react to this and should have exercised more oversight from the beginning?
Well, I think there were some of us that were, but there was a lot of new council members that were just stepping into their seats, trying to get
new
the sea
in
legs.
The role,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
So, but I, you know, it's in have all the authorities perform, you know, perfectly. No, I get about the bonuses over the years, but still, the authorities have traditionally worked very well. And the JEA, the good news is the JEA is still in very good shape despite all of this. We just need the right CEO and a good group of board members. And I'm sorry that some board members that could have performed very well won't be there, not with no blame really on them necessarily.
Julie in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Julie.
Oh, good morning. My question is kind of along the lines of the previous caller, in that I'm glad that the city council is investigating, but I haven't heard any city council member discuss the fact that the general counsel put that, quote, cone of silence, which is a ridiculous term, onto the city council, and I know my city council member didn't speak to us about any of that. So when the city council investigates, and as I understand it, the general counsel's office was speaking to the JEA when the constituents weren't allowed to get spoken, you know, to discuss this with their elected representative in an independent body. So is this investigation going to address the fact that city council members were told not to discuss something important with their constituents?
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Julie. Yeah. Here's a tweet from a listener about that. Asking you the same question, Councilman, when is somebody going to investigate the Office of General Counsel? It seems many of their decisions aren't based in the law or good public policy, but on what the mayor wanted. See, the shall versus may issue, he's referring to a school tax issue.
Yes.
The cone of silence, which Julie just mentioned, and so many other JEA decisions.
Well, the cone of silence, as was explained to me, because I went right to the general counsel. I said, we're talking about cone of silence because I'm not going to be silent about what's going on here. He said, the only thing is you and other council members should not be talking to the individual bidders, because if that information from that bidder got shared with another bidder, there'd be a violation of trade secrets. But as far as the process itself, as far as what you think about the sale of the JEA, whether it should be or shouldn't be. That's how it was explained to me. So I've been very open with all of my constituents on everything I've known about the JEA. I've been, you know, very outspoken about the JEA from the beginning. It's like I told you earlier, I don't need to read spreadsheets and studies to know when I think something's wrong.
And but should the as some voters are asking, yeah, should the Office of General Counsel, rather than being the one to run down documents and investigate, should they be investigated, is what people are asking.
Well, the Office of General Counsel's made some decisions that I didn't agree with, the shall in May. I didn't agree with that. I made that clear. And the cone of silence, I told you how they explained that to me. I thought, if I'm bidding on an insurance policy for some big account, I don't want people knowing what my rates are that maybe going over and telling somebody else. That's a trade secret. So the way that was explained to me, I don't think that was explained very well. But with this council committee, I think they will be investigating anything. But, I've known Jason Gabriel for a long time. I've not always agreed with him.
And attorney for the city.
Yes, yeah. The general counsel for the city. And when I have not agreed with him, I've told him.
So you don't agree then with some of the constituents out there that the investigative lens should be turned on that office?
Well, I think it may be. We don't know what's going to be investigated. I just hope and pray that they can withstand that degree of scrutiny. But I think that I think the whole city is open for a good scrubbing. That's what I think.
Okay, let's go to Ricky on the north side. Ricky, go ahead.
Yep.
You're on the air, Ricky. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just like to have Mr. Carlucci, what's his opinion on Curry, Mr. Curry, the mayor, being as crooked as a dog's hind leg, because all this stems from his trying to cover everything up. So that's my question.
Thank you for that. Lots of tweets and emails asking you the same thing, Councilman. Here's one from Carl. When is the mayor going to accept responsibility for this mess, looking at the large number of documented phone calls between Curry and Zahn and the number of documented visits Zahn made to City Hall? How can Curry deny he wasn't involved up to his eyes in this fiasco? That tweet sums up a number of them that we're getting in emails too. So what about that?
Well, I think that's what's on a lot of people's minds. And I've made it no secret of my concerns of the administration. I called for one of his top administrators' resignation. It didn't happen, but I called for it because I felt the people felt that way. I don't want to sit here and use the mayor as a punching bag. He's still my mayor. But I think that he has got to get out into the community and somehow find a way to build back trust. And I think he might need to restructure some things in his own office. And some of the tactics that they've used in the past, they might want to try a different approach. I've never experienced an administration like this before in my life, but I want it to be successful. He only has 3.5 years left. That's 3.5 years of my life. And at my age, that counts. So I want him to do good, but I think he's got to go out and talk to the people. And he's got to belly up to all this and give some answers. And when he does that and he can get some foothold of trust back, then the city can maybe start moving forward again.
Let's take one more call on this, and then we'll move on and talk about another big news item from the week, the city council's new resiliency committee. But one more call on this. It's Jack out at Fletcher High School. Jack, go ahead.
Hey, Mr. Carlucci. Thank you for all your work with the resiliency committee. I just wanted to have a quick comment and then question. I just want to say that with the leadership of JEA now having to take in the fall for Mr. Curry's failed policies and privatization, it's very reminiscent of a Jeremy Thorpe quote that was based off John 15:13. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his friends for his life. But with the clearing of the JEA board now happening a second time in 5 years, shouldn't the council be able to have a serious check over the mayor through the direct appointment of board members? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack. A very smart student calling in from Fletcher High.
Yeah. Thank you, Jack. That was a great question. And yes, your answer is yes. The Rules Committee is actually, in my opinion, it's just my opinion, when it's doing its job, is the most powerful committee on city council. The rules chair is the fourth in line to become mayor, not finance. So there are those of us on the council who voted against some appointments that were to the JEA. And that's not an easy thing to do. But one of them was a friend of mine. I'm not going to say who, but I just told him, I'm just telling you, brother, I care about you more than a lot of other people may. And I'm giving you my best advice. I wouldn't take that step towards that. And but he's a very civic-minded person, and he wanted to go on and do good. And maybe he made the right call. I'm not going to say not, but I said, but I will say this. Yes, I mean, we have responsibility not to just gush over every appointment that comes up before us. We have the responsibility to take it serious. And if we don't think that person should be in that position, we should vote that way. And that's not easy, but that's our that's our fiduciary responsibility to the city of Jacksonville. So, you know what? The whole city needs good scrubbing. If they need to come over and scrub me up a little bit, I'll belly up to the bar and say, okay, you know, let's talk about it. What I do this time?
You'll
you know?
Let them hose you down. You know, I think you're definitely expressing the sentiment of a lot of voters out there. And I do want, though, to shift gears while we have you here with us and talk about another important story from the week. The first convening of the new Resiliency Committee. You are chairing that committee on the City Council, looking at how to better prepare this city for rising seas, floods, more severe weather, hotter temperatures, all the effects we can expect here in Florida related to climate change. So set the stage for us on that. What can we expect out of this committee? Will the city appoint a chief resilience officer, for example? And what else are you working toward?
Okay. Let me digress just for a second, because I want to compliment our council president. He stood up strong. And people need to remember that.
Scott Wilson.
Yes. Scott Wilson, our council president, stood up strong and has created a committee that's going to do, I think, an outstanding job of investigating this whole mess. Okay. Now we're going to move forward to resiliency. I want to give council president Scott Wilson credit for creating this forward-looking committee to a future problem that we're going to have because of sea level rise, rising temperatures. And I have been thinking about this committee for a long time. As an insurance agent, I don't pretend to be an expert on resiliency, but what I am pretty much an expert on is the lack of resiliency after a storm because of all the claims that I've had to handle in my 42 years. And I'm just never seen the flooding like what we're having now. And so we had our first meeting the other day. If the fire marshal had been there, we probably wouldn't have been in deep shish kebabs because we had like 120 people in
lots
a room.
Lots of
for
interest, yeah.
Lots of interest, lots of people to leverage, lots of people have an interest in this going forward. In my opening statement, I said that in 6 months, I would like to have a package of policies towards mitigating the effects of sea level rise ready to pass City Council. And I want us to begin looking at the responsibilities of a chief resiliency officer and start looking at the budget for a chief resiliency officer so we can have one perhaps in place within a year.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. So a package of policies within 6 months, what might those policies involve?
The policies might involve where you can build, where you can't build. They might be building code ordinances that would be stricter on building our homes and our buildings, where they could be built. There was a AAA study that was done in the mayor's office, to their credit, have done some work on this that has given us a good place to start, a good starting point. Bill Killingsworth, the planning director, and John Pappas, and many citizens worked on some of these issues revolving around resiliency. And so we've got a good place to start, and that's where we'll get many of our many of our policies. But we got to be thinking towards the future. Like, for example, the JEA building, the new JEA building. Okay, it's being built to withstand a Category 3 hurricane. Yeah, this is hindsight, I guess, at this point, but it really should be built to Category 5 strength, because Category 3s used to be like almost unheard of hitting the shore. Category 5s are now hitting the shore. A Category 3 hits Jacksonville from the Atlantic. Our community will be stunned at the amount of water. They will be, if you think they were stunned in Matthew and Irma, they will be stunned at the volume of water all over the city. So this is not an issue we can sit back and do nothing about. We've got to, you know, during the spring, everything's beautiful outside. Flowers are blooming. Nobody's thinking. But then when June, July, August, September come along, we start thinking about, you know, the hurricanes coming, you know, over the Atlantic or through the Gulf, heading towards Jacksonville.
Right. It's my understanding, a speaker from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers spoke before this committee and talked about how important it is that Jacksonville make sure that essential services like hospitals and police stations are functioning during an extreme weather event or severe flooding. The State Department of Environmental Protection is already funding a resiliency analysis for Jacksonville.
Yes.
That is also something to watch.
That's huge. That's a vulnerability study. It's going to show when it's through. And again, this is from the mayor's office, in Bill Killingsworth and Public Works Director John Pappas. They applied for a grant and put up a big chunk of city money as well. And this vulnerability study is going to show where most of our vulnerable areas are. Those are the areas that we need to start finding out, you know, whether people should continue to live there, whether they are bought out by FEMA, helped to be moved somewhere else. I don't know how much of that there will be. But I will tell you, you live through one flood and you're going to be thinking about maybe we need to go somewhere else. You know,
and if you're just tuning in, we're now talking about the City Council's Committee on Resiliency with Councilman Matt Carlucci. We want your questions about this at 549-2937. Two more follow-ups for you, Councilman. People who came to this meeting had public comment opportunities, and they asked you both about the planned dredging of the St. John's River, which researchers say will exacerbate the effects of sea level rise and flooding, and also whether Jacksonville would join a host of other Florida cities and commit to emissions reductions, becoming a carbon neutral or at least a less carbon heavy city to mitigate more against the effects of climate change. Will the Resiliency Committee take a position on either one of those matters?
Well, I think that we need to. The carbon emissions, actually we're already starting on that a little bit with the efforts of former council person and DIA chair Lori Boyer. She's really turning a lot of parts of Jacksonville into more walkable areas, places that are friendly for bicyclists, although I don't think I'm going to be riding my bike to work in June.
But, right.
But, you know, we're taking some steps towards that already. That's going to have to be increased. And what was the other question that you have? Sorry.
The dredging.
Oh, the dredging. Okay.
Yeah.
So here was what I'm faced with as I'm going through my campaign. I'm really concerned about resilience. The other issue I'm really concerned about is 40% of Jacksonville families live at or just above or below the poverty level, and we need more jobs. The port dredge will bring more jobs. Now, if we do dredge, there's mitigation efforts with the resilience that can help offset that, and that would be dredging out some of our Rebalt rivers and other tributaries to their original depth that would swallow up some of that water. So, but I feel jobs is hugely important. Good paying jobs is hugely important to this community. I don't think a lot of people know how many people in, I don't think that many people know the families that are living from paycheck to paycheck.
And by the way, we're getting a question about that, how climate change will affect lower income folks. It's Bill in St. Augustine. Bill, good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just asking after going through both Matthew and Irma down here, there's a large number of low-income families, especially low-income seniors, that live in these existing neighborhoods. And when we all talk about resiliency and new codes, no one seems to really be thinking about the huge volume of people that are in these neighborhoods that are already at risk. And you've got HUD, you've got CDBG, you have SHIP if the state doesn't steal the money every year. But those are the biggest folks that are negatively impacted every time there's some kind of a storm. And I'm just curious if these resiliency discussions look at those neighborhoods very much.
Sure. That is a huge part of the challenge. People in lower income neighborhoods always take the brunt of this.
Well, and here's the, Bill obviously understands a lot about this. I'm still learning, okay? So I'm still learning as I go. I just know this problem. But I do know that a lot of our vulnerable neighborhoods, matter of fact, maybe a majority of our neighborhoods that are at risk are in vulnerable neighborhoods. And a lot of those have failing septic tanks. So our committee also has the charge that can look at failing septic tanks, because when you have a flood and you got a failing septic tank, that's not making for a healthy environment for children and for those elderly families and just general people in general. This is going to be I think this committee will probably advance in our knowledge and our understanding. We have a great committee made up of council members who really care. And we're going to be looking at those that are that could be trapped, and people that don't need mm-hmm. to be trapped. And he's talking about St. Augustine. My wife and I have a place down in Bass Haven. He might know where that's at. It's near Picolata. If you don't know where Picolata is, it's about 7 miles south of Orangedale. If you don't know where Orangedale is, it's about 15 miles south of Julington Creek.
In other words, it's a haul.
it's not too long to get to, but it's like being a long ways away when you're there. We have a little place down there called Camp Carlucci. We had another property. It flooded out with Matthew. We fixed it all up, and like so many other people experienced, then Irma came and reflooded it. I just said, I'm not up to this. We're just going to sell this property as is.
See, that's the thing. At a certain point, is there going to be panic selling in a lot of neighborhoods? And that, you know, this committee has to get its arms around that, too.
Well, if a neighborhood is eligible for a buyout, like over in South Shores, and Lori Boyer, I give her a lot of credit because she took that. That was a tough issue. I said, boy, that's going to be a tough issue for her. But she went out and she explained to the neighbors, listen, you can continue to live here, continue to get flooded out, or we can buy you out. It was FEMA that provided the dollars. And people could decide whether they wanted to take what their house value was, not after two storms, but after just the one. And a lot of families took advantage of that and they moved.
And then
area becomes a park. Other than
right.
when it's flooded out.
Exactly. And more of that, unfortunately, is on the horizon. So we will definitely keep following it. And we thank you. He's City Councilman-at-Large Matt Carlucci with us today. Thanks for stopping by.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Up next, virtual reality in the classroom for kids who can't get out into the natural world. That's in our Going Green. We'll be right back.
I'm Brendan Rivers, host of WJCT's Adapt podcast, where we hear from people in our area helping us adapt to climate change and sea level rise. But first, people have to want to adapt. That's where Lauren Watkins comes in, a professional climate change communicator who gets why that can be tricky, even when she's talking to her own mom.
it can be done and it can happen where you can get to neutral ground and think about solutions.
Subscribe to ADAPT wherever you get your podcasts or listen at adaptflorida.org.
WJCT invites you to join us for an evening with Ari Shapiro on Thursday, April 2nd. Award-winning journalist and weekday co-host of All Things Considered, NPR's award-winning afternoon news program, will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, for an engaging conversation. Visit wjct.org/events for ticket information. Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. It's an intriguing virtual reality program for local elementary school children, and it's getting them excited about the natural world. Josie Spearman is education coordinator at the GTM Research Reserve. She's here with more in our Going Green. Josie, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to meet you, Melissa.
Nice to have you. So you've been going out and meeting with local fourth grade kids for over a year now.
Yes.
And this is a virtual reality program to help them understand the incredible beauty of the research reserve, I guess. How does this work?
Absolutely. So what we did was we essentially took our school program, which is based on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They have a suite of education programs called Estuaries 101. So one of ours that's based on that, we took it, basically the kids in the field working in salt marshes in an estuary environment, and we took it. We did 360-degree filming of the estuary. We went out into the mud, went out into the grasses, went out into the oyster reefs, and we stitched all that video together in a software specifically for virtual reality, and we uploaded into the Oculus Go headset. And so now when these students put this headset on, it's like they are able to be in the salt marsh without actually physically being there.
That is just amazing, because what many listeners out there might not realize is that there are so many schools in this listening area that just can't afford to transport students to a field trip at the reserve. There are so many kids in this city who've never been to the beach, never been to the Guana Reserve, all these beautiful natural places around the First Coast. So this brings the experience and the education right to the students who can't afford, for whatever reason, to get out there.
Absolutely. And the whole premise of this grant that we accepted, or that we applied for and were funded for, was that we wanted to reach out to the students who had transportation and distance limitations. So virtual reality was a really big way for us to increase our distance learning opportunities.
Okay. So virtual reality is an amazing technology in so many ways. When these kids put on the headset, does it really feel as though they're there? I mean, does it really simulate the feeling of being there?
As much as it possibly can. Of course, there's nothing quite like actually being in the marsh and smelling the mud and digging your hands through it and feeling crabs crawl across your hands.
Yeah.
But this is a close second best. So with a lot of really interesting technology, embedding sounds into it so that they can actually hear ambient noises that would be in the marsh, it really creates an entire experience that's very close to the real thing.
And we should note that this isn't intended to replace actual field trips. This is just a really cool alternative.
Right, right, exactly. So we don't want to prevent them from coming on site. In fact, we want to encourage it, and we hope that by piquing their interest with this immersive experience, they will then be able to come out on site with a better knowledge of the estuary, and that we would eventually be able to actually help them to come on site if they are having funding difficulties.
Now, you also hope to start testing this out for high-functioning verbal and nonverbal autistic students, too.
Yes, that's one of our biggest new projects. So we're really working with a lot of local organizations, working with curriculum specialists to refine how we understand how students with autism are able to learn, and so that we basically learn how to help them learn using this technology.
So this entire virtual reality program then is aligned with that. It's called the GTM for All initiative. Can you explain what that's all about?
Absolutely. It was an initiative that was began in the winter of 2018, and it was through the National Estuarine Research Reserve Association. And what we were basically doing is reaching out to our community members so that all of our community would have opportunities to engage in environmental education and stewardship projects. And so we've been reaching out to deaf, low-hearing community members, blind, low-vision, students with autism, intellectual disabilities, and people who are limited by mobility or even distance.
How amazing is that? Now, GTM stands for, correct me if I'm wrong, Guanatolomato Matanzas.
Absolutely, yes.
So I hope that lets people who are listening to this get a mental picture of where this reserve is. If you've ever driven down A1A south of Ponte Vedra and driven through that beautiful wildness that is the Guana Preserve, you keep on driving and you eventually make your way to the GTM Research Reserve. There are several of these all over the country, and they are really incredible gems. What do you love the most about that place? Because I've been there several times. You're there every day. What do you love the most about it?
Well, I can honestly say that I absolutely do love my job. And that's not just like, is anybody listening that works there? No, I really do love my job. It's the environment, it's the dynamic atmosphere. It's the chance for me to learn about things. I love learning. So with my job, I'm able to learn about new technology, new research projects, and then I get the fun opportunity to then interpret that for students and the public. So that's actually a lot of fun to do.
And I would think too, just being in that beautiful setting is just good for the soul. If you love biodiversity and you love the natural world, you really need to go visit this place because it's unique. Can you explain why this is a unique spot on the map?
Yes, it's a very pristine environment. You're able to do everything from kayaking, bring your horses or your dogs on trails. You get to experience watching migratory birds or butterflies go in. I have to say that during my lunch break, I can go out and watch dolphins if they're coming into the estuary to teach their young how to feed. So it's an absolutely amazing experience, and it's very calming and centering for you to be there.
And it's free, essentially. And anyone can come visit. Mm-hmm. So if you're curious, you can always contact the GTM Research Reserve at 823-4500. Or just head down A1A and look for the sign. They are in between Ponte Vedra and St. Augustine, I think is probably the easiest way to explain to people where they're located. What a beautiful program. And thank you for all you do, Josie. It's really fascinating stuff. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. I'm happy to do it.
She's Josie Spearman, Education Coordinator at the GTM Research Reserve. A quick break, and up next, Ancient Egypt comes to life with a modern day theme at the Kummer Museum. We'll be right back.
Jacksonville Country Day School. Through intellectual exploration involving project-based and transformative learning, JCDS prepares pre-K 3 through 6th grade students for success at the next academic level and beyond. More at jcds.com.
Open house on February 4th, 9:30 a.m.
Osteen Volvo Cars of Jacksonville, family-owned and operated for over 24 years, offers more than just luxury. Their full line is known for 5-star safety, style, and sophistication. Osteen Volvo, 10863 Phillips Highway, keeping families safe for generations.
No passport is required to explore the intersection of food and culture in Jacksonville's immigrant communities. Join WJCT for No Passport Required in Jacksonville, an engaging community discussion on Tuesday, February 11th. The event is free, but space is limited. Visit wjct.org/events to reserve your spot today.
The president's impeachment lawyers have finished their defense as the pressure to include witnesses grows.
Nothing in the Bolton revelations, even if true, would rise to the level of abuse of power or an impeachable offense. That is clear from history.
Join us for special coverage as the questioning begins on the eighth day of the Senate impeachment trial from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Ambassador John Bolton has a book to sell. Could it write the next chapter for what happens in the Senate?
It's important to be able to hear from John Bolton for us to be able to make an impartial judgment.
I'm Todd Zwillick. As the president's impeachment lawyers wrap up their case, how will they deal with the growing furor over a key witness? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. It's called Striking Power, a new exhibit that explores the practice of iconoclasm through a collection of works from ancient Egypt. And it opens at the Cummer Museum of Art and Gardens this Friday. Chief Curator Holly Karras is here now to take us back to ancient Egypt. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Okay, let's first explain that SAT word to everybody. What is iconoclasm?
Basically just means image destruction is the easiest way to think about it.
Image destruction.
Yeah, so iconoclasm, image destruction, although our exhibition is contextualizing that within ancient Egypt, it's not something that is specific to ancient Egypt. It's not specific to a particular time period or a particular geography. This is a worldwide phenomenon, but our exhibition is focusing really on the pharaonic period of ancient Egypt up through the early Christian period.
Okay.
And how those images, what we think of today is just an image, right? For the ancient Egyptians, just had so much more meaning and power. An image was actually the representation of that particular pharaoh, that particular god, that particular goddess on earth for perpetuity. So, you know, destroying an image, intentionally harming an image like that has a lot more significance behind it.
Because some of these pieces of art will feature intentionally damaged
yes.
works.
This is not just, you know, it's old and there's been erosion and all that. This is literally showing ritualized destruction of images. So for example, if you had a portrait of a pharaoh and that is supposed to represent him in that temple or that tomb in perpetuity, and you get rid of his nose, he can't breathe. And if you get rid of his eyes, he can't see. And if you get rid of his hands and arms, he can't give or receive offerings. So you are rendering him, through your ritualized destruction, you're rendering him useless now for all eternity.
That's fascinating.
It's a great way to, you know, get rid of some of your enemies.
So it's like the ancient version of unfollowing someone on Twitter.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so what's cool about this is that there are modern day applications for this whole idea of image destruction.
Sure.
As we're having a local conversation about Confederate monuments in this city, for example, what are some lessons we can draw from ancient Egypt?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think one of the big things, as I mentioned, is that this idea of, you know, images being wrapped up and associated with significant power and meaning is not new to our own time. So one of the things that we're actually doing in relationship to the exhibition is offering a four-part lecture series with Adam Levine, our CEO and executive director, and having conversations about how iconoclasm has played out in different times in different places, including our own.
That is very cool. You're also having an Egyptian dinner party?
We like to throw a good party.
That yeah. sounds fun.
Yes.
Is it going to be in the middle of the exhibit?
It's no food and drink in the exhibition, but if you put your drink down outside, you'll be able to go
out
in.
Out in the garden.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's coming up. And you also have an interesting evening coming up. The Murder of Tutankhamun.
I mean,
an expert on mummies is coming to the Cummer to talk.
I mean, come on. Who doesn't love a good mummy?
I'm fascinated by mummification. I have to say, well, of course, people all over the world are.
Yes.
What the ancient Egyptians, the lengths they would go to preserve.
To preserve. I mean, that's what that again, that kind of just reinforces this idea of why these images were so important.
And the expert you're having, Dr. Bob Breyer, he will present his theory about the death of King Tut.
Yes.
Can you give me a sneak peek?
I cannot give you a sneak peek. You're going to have to come on February 26 and hear it for yourself.
All right. So that's coming up. And then in March, it's Striking Up, Conversation, Performance, and Art with Phase 8 Theater Company.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really great night. Again, kind of tying that into some more contemporary, more of a dialogue.
So much happening at the Kummer Museum around this exhibit. Striking Power opens this Friday, runs through April. And by the way, this Saturday is the museum's monthly Weaver First Saturday Free for All. Thanks, of course, to Jay Wayne and Dolores Barr Weaver. So if you want to come check it out this Saturday, there's no admission. Kummer.org for a lot more about all of this. And the Kummer Museum is just on a roll with incredible exhibits and activities. So Holly Karras, Chief Curator, kudos to you. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Well, that is our show. Again, just go to Kummer.org to learn more about that exhibit, Striking Power. And here's a little music just for you. This is, yes, Walk Like an Egyptian. We just thought,
had to.
Why not? Our producer is Heather Schatz. She pulled this music. Good job, Heather. Michelle Corum directs the show. Our station news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. We value your feedback at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, it'll rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Let's connect then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.